What possible assurance do you have that Sensomatic will go up in price? And if you're buying, how much should you pay? What you're really asking is, what is it that makes a company valuable? Why will it be more valuable tomorrow than it is today? There are many theories, but to me, it always comes down to earnings and assets, especially earnings. Analyze a company's stock on the basis of earnings and assets is no different from analyzing a laundromat, a drugstore, or an apartment building. Although it's easy to forget sometimes, a share of stock is not a lottery ticket. It's part ownership of a business. When you buy stock in a fast-growing company, you're really betting on its chances to earn more money in the future. That's why investors seek out promising fast growers. They bid the stocks up even when the companies are earning very little. People may wonder what the Japanese are doing, but the earnings will decide the fate of a stock. People may bet on the hourly wiggles in the market, but it's the earnings that waggle the wiggles over the long term. Any serious discussion of earnings involves the price-to-earnings ratio, also known as the P/E ratio. This ratio is a numerical shorthand for the relationship between the stock price and the earnings of the company. The P/E ratio for the stock is listed in the daily stock tables of most major newspapers. Like the earnings line, the P/E ratio is often a useful tool to help you determine whether the stock is fairly priced in relation to the company's money-making potential. The P/E ratio we thought of is a number of years it will take the company to earn back the amount of your initial investment, assuming the company's earnings stay constant. If you buy shares in a company selling at 2x earnings or at a P/E of 2, your initial investment is earned back in 2 years. If you buy shares in a company selling at 40x earnings or a P/E of 40, it takes 40 years to accomplish the same thing. With all the low P/E opportunities around, why would anyone buy a stock with a high P/E? The only reason is because they're looking for a fast grower. They're investing in the company's potential. You'll also find that the P/E levels tend to be low for slow growers and high for fast growers. The cyclicals vacillate in between. If you remember only one point about P/E ratios, you should remember to avoid stocks with excessively high P/Es. An extremely high P/E is a handicap to a stock most of the time. Company P/E ratios do not exist in a vacuum. The stock market has its own collective P/E ratio, which is a good indicator whether the market at large is over or undervalued. I know I've already advised you to ignore the market, but when you find a few stocks are selling at inflated prices, it's likely that most stocks are selling at inflated prices. That's what happened before the big drop in 1973 and 74, and also in 1987. How can you predict future earnings? The best you can do with current earnings is make an educated guess as to whether a stock is fairly priced. If you do this much, you'll never overpay for Bristol-Myers, Coca-Cola, or McDonald's. However, what you'd really like to know is what's going to happen to earnings in the next month, year, or decade. Battalions of analysts and statisticians are launched against the questions of future growth and earnings. I'm not about to suggest that you can begin to predict earnings or growth in earnings successfully on your own. So you can't predict future earnings, but you can find out how a company plans to increase earnings. Then you can check periodically to see if the plans are working out. There are 5 basic ways a company can increase its earnings. They are reduce cost, raise prices, expand into new markets, sell more of its product in the old markets, and revitalize, close, or dispose of losing operations. These are the factors to investigate as you develop the story. If you have an edge, this is where it's going to be the most helpful.
This is the end of Side 1B. On Side 2A, Peter Lynch continues his discussion on how to develop the story on a company and increase your chances to pick out winning stocks. Chapter 11, The 2-Minute Drill.
At this point, you should know whether you're dealing with a slow grower, a stalwart, a fast grower, a turnaround, an asset play, or cyclical. The price-earnings ratio has given you a rough idea of whether the stock is currently undervalued or overvalued relative to its immediate prospects. The next step is to learn what the company is doing to bring about added prosperity, increased growth, or whatever happy event is expected to occur. This is known as the story. Something dynamic must happen to keep the earnings moving along. The more certain you are about what that something is, the better you'll be able to follow the script. Analyst reports and short essays in the publication Value Line provide the professional version of the story. But you can develop your own detailed script if you've got an edge on the company. Before buying a stock, everyone should be able to give a short monologue summarizing why they're interested in the company. The following sample monologues are examples of ones that have worked well for me in the past few years. If it's a slow-growing company, you're probably in it for the dividend. The important elements of the script include: this company has increased its earnings every year for the last 10. It offers an attractive yield. It's never reduced or suspended a dividend. In fact, it's raised the dividend during good times and bad. It's a telephone utility, so the new cellular operations may add a kicker to the growth rate. If it's a cyclical company, your script revolves around business conditions, inventories, and prices. There has been a 3-year slump in the auto industry, but this year, things have turned around. Car sales are up for the first time in recent memory. GM's new models are selling well. In the last 18 months, GM has closed 5 inefficient plants, cut 20% off labor costs, and earnings are about to turn sharply higher. If it's an asset play, what are the assets? How much are they worth? The stock sells for $8, but the video cassette division alone is worth $4 a share, and the real estate is worth another $7. That's a bargain. I'm getting the rest of the company for -3. Insiders are buying, the company has steady earnings, and there's no debt to speak of. If it's a turnaround, has the company taken action to improve its fortunes? Is the plan working? General Mills has made great progress in curing its diversification. It's gone from 11 businesses to 2. The company has sold Eddie Bauer, Talbots, Kenner, and Parker Brothers for top dollar, and has returned to what it knows best: restaurants and packaged foods. If it's a stalwart, the key issues are the P.E. ratio, whether the stock has already had a recent run-up in price, and what, if anything, is happening to accelerate the growth rate. Coca-Cola is selling at the low end of its P.E. range. The stock hasn't gone anywhere for 2 years, but the company has improved itself. Coca-Cola sold half its interest in Columbia Pictures to the public. Diet drinks have sped up the growth rate. Foreign sales are increasing. In the past few years, the company has bought out many of its independent bottlers. Coca-Cola has better control over distribution and domestic sales now. If it's a fast grower, where and how can it continue to grow fast? La Quinta is a motel chain that began in Texas and was very profitable. The company duplicated its successful formula in Arkansas and Louisiana. Last year, it added 20% more motel units than the year before. Earnings have increased every quarter. The company plans rapid future expansion, and its debt is not excessive. Motels are a low-growth, competitive industry, but La Quinta has found a niche. It has a long way to go before it has saturated the market. I often devote several hours to developing a script. Let me give you 2 examples. The first is a situation I checked out properly. That was La Quinta Motor Inns, which was a 15-bagger for me. In the second example, there was something I forgot to ask. That was Bildner's, a 15-bagger in reverse. The motel industry was due for a cyclical turnaround. I'd already invested in United Inns, the largest franchisee of Holiday Inns. During a telephone interview with the vice president at United Inns, I asked which company was Holiday Inn's most successful competitor. Asking about the competition is one of my favorite techniques for finding promising new stocks. Muckamucks speak negatively about the competition most of the time. But when an executive of one company admits he's impressed by another company, you can bet the competitor is doing something right. La Quinta Motor Inns, vice president of United Inns enthused, they're doing a great job. They're killing us in Houston and in Dallas. That was the first time I had ever heard of La Quinta. I wanted to know what the story was. The concept was simple. La Quinta offered rooms of Holiday Inn quality at lower prices. La Quinta had eliminated the wedding area, the conference rooms, the large reception area, the kitchen area, and the restaurant. Excess space contributing nothing to profits while adding to the costs. La Quinta's idea was to install a Denny's or similar 24-hour place next door to each motel. Somebody else would worry about the food. Most hotels and motels lose money on their restaurants. Where was the niche? La Quinta had a specific target, the small businessman who didn't care for the budget motel but didn't want to spend a lot of money either. If he had the choice, he'd rather pay less for the equivalent luxury of a Holiday Inn. La Quinta was there to provide the equivalent luxury, and at locations are often more convenient to traveling businessmen. Because La Quinta's guests were business travelers, a high percentage of them booked rooms in advance. This gave La Quinta the advantage of a more predictable clientele. Nobody had captured this part of the market, the middle ground underneath the Hilton hotels and the Holiday Inns, but above the budget inns. La Quinta was a great story. They had been operating for several years by the time I heard about them. The original La Quinta had been duplicated in many different locations. The company was growing at an astounding 50% a year, and the stock was selling at a very attractive 10 times earnings multiple. This made it an incredible bargain. To top it off, I was delighted to discover that only 3 brokerage firms covered La Quinta. Also, less than 20% of the stock was held by institutions, another major positive. I followed up by spending 3 nights in 3 different La Quintas. I was satisfied La Quinta was Holiday Inn's equal. I bought as much La Quinta as possible for the Magellan Fund. I made 11-fold on it over a 5-year period before it suffered a turndown. I made 2 major mistakes with J. Bildner and Sons. Bildner's is a specialty food store located across the street from my Boston office. It sells gourmet sandwiches and prepared hot foods. Bildner's is a cross between a convenience store and a 3-star restaurant. I had first-hand information that they had the best bread and the best sandwiches in Boston. That was my edge. Bildner's was going public to raise money so it could expand into other locations. The company had carved out a niche, the millions of white-collar types who won't eat microwave sandwiches and who also refuse to cook. I researched the operation by wandering into the store across the street. It was clean, efficient, full of satisfied customers, and a fabulous moneymaker. From the prospectus of the stock offering, I learned that Bildner's wasn't going to burden itself with excessive bank debt. This was a plus. Without further investigation, I bought Bildner's at the initial offering price of $13 in September 1986. Soon after the sale of stock, Bildner's opened 2 outlets and a couple of Boston department stores. They flopped. Then it opened 3 new outlets in mid-Manhattan. They were killed by the delis. It continued to expand into more distant cities. By quickly spending more than the proceeds from the public offering, Bildner's had financially overextended itself. 1 or 2 mistakes at a time might not have been so bad, but Bildner's suffered multiple simultaneous failures. I'm sure the company learned from these mistakes, but there was no second chance once the money ran out. The stock bottomed at 1/8 of a dollar. The management retreated to its original stores, including the one across from my office. I gradually unloaded my shares at losses ranging from 50 to 95%. The lesson here is if the prototype is in Texas, hold off buying until the company shows it can make money in Illinois. Does the idea work in some other place? That's the question I forgot to ask builders.
Chapter 12, Getting the Facts.
Fund managers have an advantage when it comes to getting the facts in a company. Companies will talk to us several times a week if we'd like. On the other hand, I can't imagine any useful information that the amateur investor can't get. All the pertinent facts are waiting to be picked up. Companies are required to tell nearly all in their prospectuses, quarterlies, and annual reports. Stockbrokers can be your information gatherers. They can provide the S&P reports, investment newsletters, annuals, quarterlies, and prospectuses, the Value Line survey, and their firm's research. Let them get the data on the P/E ratios, growth rates, insider buying, and institutional ownership. They'll be happy to do it once they realize you're serious. Professionals call companies all the time. Amateurs rarely think of it. The investor relations office is a good place for you to get answers to specific questions. Prepare your questions before you call the company. Earnings are a good topic, but it's not proper etiquette to ask the company how much you're going to make, any more than it's proper for strangers to ask you for your annual salary. The accepted form of question is subtle. What are the Wall Street estimates on your company's earnings for the upcoming year is a better question. As you already know, future earnings are hard to predict. The companies themselves aren't sure how much they will earn. What you really want from investor relations is the company's reaction to whatever script you've been trying to develop. If you don't have a script, you can learn something by asking two general questions. What are the positives this year, and what are the negatives? In most cases, you'll hear something that confirms what you suspected, especially if you understand the business. But every so often, you'll learn something unexpected. Things are either better or worse than they appear. The unexpected can be very profitable if you're buying or selling stocks. When you call investor relations, you can have confidence the facts you get are correct. The adjectives, though, will vary widely. Different kinds of companies use different words to describe the same scene. It's important to remember, when looking at the same sky, people in mature industries see clouds, where people in immature industries see pie. Don't waste your time deciphering the corporate vocabulary. It's simpler to ignore all the adjectives. Wandering through stores and tasting things is one of my research strategies. Although it's not a substitute for asking the right questions, it's reassuring to personally check out the product. Before I bought La Quinta, I spent a few nights in the Motor Inns. I could have gotten the information from investor relations, but it wouldn't have been the same thing as bouncing on their beds. It's no surprise that so many annual reports end up in the garbage can. The text on the glossy pages is understandable, but normally useless. The numbers in the back can sometimes seem incomprehensible and intimidating. But there's a way to get something out of an annual report. It only takes a few minutes. Consider the 1987 Ford Motor annual report. Turn directly to the consolidated balance sheet on the cheaper paper. The general rule with annual reports is the cheaper the paper, the more valuable the information. The balance sheet lists the assets and the liabilities of the company. I look at the current assets column and take the cash figure and add that number to the marketable securities. The total is the company's overall cash position. Comparing the 1987 cash to the 1986 cash, also listed, I see Ford is socking away a lot of money. This is a sign of prosperity. Then I look at the other half of the balance sheet to the entry that says long-term debt. I see that the 1987 long-term debt has been greatly reduced from 1986. Debt reduction is another sign of prosperity. A balance sheet is improving when cash is increasing relative to debt. Subtracting the long-term debt from the total cash, I arrive at Ford's net cash position. The cash and cash assets greatly exceed the debt. When cash exceeds debt, it's very favorable. No matter what happens, Ford isn't going out of business. To keep it simple, ask your broker whether Ford is buying back shares, whether cash exceeds long-term debt, and how much cash there is per share. You can also get the numbers from the S&P reports or from Valueline. Valueline is easier to read than a balance sheet and a good place for an amateur to start. It tells you about the cash and debt, summarizes the long-term record, so you can see what happened during the last recession. It also rates companies for financial strength on a scale of 1 to 5. This rating gives you an idea of a company's ability to withstand adversity. To summarize the material on the 2-minute drill and getting the facts, the difference between gambling and investing is knowing what you own, checking the financial condition, and constantly monitoring the story.
Chapter 13, Some Famous Numbers.
When a specific product arouses my interest in a company, the first thing I want to know is what the product means to the company. What percent of sales does it represent? Legg sent Hanes stock soaring because Hanes was a relatively small company. Pampers was a more profitable product than Legg's, but it didn't mean as much to the huge Procter & Gamble. We've already talked about the price-to-earnings ratio, but I want to add another bit of information. The P/E ratio of any fairly priced company will equal its growth rate. In general, a P/E ratio that's half the growth rate is very positive, and one that's twice the growth rate is very negative. We use this measure all the time to analyze stocks for the mutual funds. You want to know if a company's sitting on billions in cash. Let's look at Ford. In the last chapter, we established that Ford had loads of cash in relation to its long-term debt. Cash doesn't always make a difference. More often than not, there isn't enough of it to worry about. Nevertheless, it's always advisable to check the cash position as part of your research. How much does a company owe? How much does it own? Debt versus equity. It's the kind of thing a loan officer wants to know about you when deciding whether you're a good credit risk. A normal corporate balance sheet has two sides. The left side lists the assets. The right side shows how the assets are financed. The right side can be divided into debt and equity. One quick way to determine the financial strength of a company is to compare the equity with its total debt. I pay special attention to the debt factor in turnarounds in troubled companies. More than anything else, it's debt that determines which companies will survive and which will go bankrupt. Young companies with heavy debts are always at risk. It's also the kind of debt, as much as the actual amount, that separates the winners from the losers in a crisis. There's bank debt and there's funded debt. Bank debt is the worst kind from the investor's point of view because it's due on demand. It doesn't have to come from a bank. It can take the form of commercial paper, which is loaned from one company to another for a short period of time. The important thing to remember is that it's due very soon. Sometimes it's due on call. This means the lender can ask for his money back at the first sign of trouble. If the borrower can't pay back the money, it's off to Chapter 11. Funded debt, the best kind from the shareholder's point of view, can never be called in as long as the borrower continues to pay the interest. The principal may not be due for 15 to 30 years. Funded debt usually takes the form of regular corporate bonds with long maturities. Unlike banks, bondholders cannot demand immediate repayment of principal. Funded debt gives companies time to wiggle out of trouble. One of the important numbers to consider is the cash dividend. Stocks paying dividends are often favored over stocks that don't pay dividends by investors who want the extra income. But the real issue is how the dividend, or the lack of a dividend, affects the value of a company and its stock price over time. One strong argument in favor of companies that pay dividends is that companies that don't pay dividends have a history of blowing the money on diversifications. Another point in favor of dividend-paying stocks is that the presence of the dividend can keep the stock price from falling as far as it might if there is no dividend. A company with a long record of regularly raising the dividend is your best bet. Stocks like Kellogg and Ralston Purina have not eliminated or reduced dividends during the last 3 wars and 8 recessions. This is the kind of stock you want to own if you believe in dividends. Heavily indebted companies can never offer the same assurance as a company with little debt. An easy number to find is book value. You can find it everywhere. People often invest on the theory that if the book value is $20 a share and the stock sells for $10 a share, they're getting something for half price. But the flaw in this is that the stated book value may not reflect the actual value of the company. It often understates or overstates reality. For example, Penn Central had a book value of more than $60 a share when it went bankrupt. Overvalued assets on the left side of a balance sheet are especially treacherous when there's a lot of debt on the right. Let's say a company shows $400 million in assets and $300 million in debt. This results in a positive book value of $100 million. You know the debt part is a real number. But if the $400 million in assets will bring only $200 million in a bankruptcy sale, then the actual book value is a negative $100 million rather than a positive $100 million. The company is less than worthless. When you buy a stock for its book value, you must have a detailed understanding of what those values really are. At Penn Central, tunnels through mountains that hadn't been used for years were counted as assets. As often as book value overstates true worth, it can also understate true worth. This is where you find the greatest asset plays. There are many kinds of hidden assets. Sometimes companies own natural resources like land, oil, or precious metals. They may carry these assets on their books at a fraction of the true value. If a company has a large inventory of gold, they may carry it on the books at the original purchase price. As gold has risen sharply in the last 40 years, that's a hidden asset. Earlier I mentioned Pebble Beach, a great hidden asset play in real estate. Real estate plays like that are everywhere. Sometimes you'll find an oil company that's kept the inventory in the ground for 40 years at original cost. The oil alone is worth more than the current price of all the shares of the stock. Another important number to consider is the cash flow of a company. Cash flow is the amount of money a company takes in as a result of doing business. All companies take in cash, but some have to spend more than others to get it. Let's say Pig Iron Inc. sells out its entire inventory and makes $100 million. That's good. Then again, Pig Iron Inc. has to spend $80 million to keep the furnaces up to date. That's bad. If Pig Iron doesn't spend $80 million on furnace improvement, it loses business to more efficient competitors. Philip Morris doesn't have this problem. The cash that comes in doesn't have to struggle against the cash that goes out. It's simply easier for Philip Morris to earn money than it is for Pig Iron Inc. A lot of people use the cash flow numbers to evaluate stocks. If cash flow is mentioned as a reason to buy a stock, be sure it's free cash flow. Free cash flow is what's left over after the normal capital spending is deducted. Pig Iron Inc. will have a lot less free cash flow than Philip Morris. Annual reports include a detailed note on inventories in a footnote section to the balance sheet. Check to see if inventories are piling up. An inventory buildup is usually a bad sign. When inventories grow faster than sales, it's a red flag. There are two basic accounting methods used to compute the value of inventories, and one or the other is used in the annual report. They are LIFO and FIFO. As much as this sounds like a pair of poodles, LIFO stands for last in, first out, and FIFO stands for first in, first out. If a company bought gold 30 years ago for $40 an ounce, and yesterday they bought gold for $400 an ounce, and today they sell some gold for $450 an ounce, what is the profit? Under LIFO, it's $50 or $450 minus $400. And under FIFO, it's 410 or 450 minus 40. Under FIFO, the profit is $410, or over 8 times the $50 profit using LIFO accounting. Whichever method is used, it's possible to compare this year's LIFO or FIFO value to last year's LIFO or FIFO value. This way you can determine whether there's been an increase or decrease in the size of the inventory. One of the most popular misconceptions in Wall Street is that the word growth is synonymous with the word expansion. This leads people to overlook some great growth companies like Philip Morris. You wouldn't see it from the industry because U.S. cigarette consumption is growing at a negative annual rate of about minus 2%. Foreign smokers, however, have taken up where the U.S. smokers left off. But even the foreign sales don't account for Philip Morris's success. The key is that Philip Morris increases its earnings by lowering costs and raising prices. That's the only growth rate that really counts, earnings.
Chapter 14, Rechecking the Story.
Rechecking the company's story every few months is a worthwhile habit. This may involve reading the latest value line or quarterly report. It can be researching the sales and earnings. Has the story changed? When fast grows especially, you'll have to ask, what will keep them growing? There are three phases to a growth company's life. The startup phase, when it works out the kinks in the business, the rapid expansion phase, when it moves into new markets, and the mature phase, also known as the saturation phase. This third phase is when the company begins to prepare for the fact there's no easy way to continue expanding. The first phase is the riskiest for the investor because the success of the enterprise isn't established. The second phase is the safest, and it's when the shareholder normally makes most of his money. The company grows by duplicating its successful formula. The third phase is the most problematic. This is when the company runs into its limitations. New methods must be developed to increase earnings. You'll want to determine whether the company seems to be moving from one phase into another as you recheck the story. If you look at automatic data processing, the paycheck processing company, you can see that they're beginning to approach saturation of the market. Automatic data processing is late in phase two. When Sensomatic was expanding its shoplifting detection system, the stock went from 2 to 40. Eventually, it reached the limit. Very few new stores to approach. The company was unable to think of new ways to maintain its momentum. The stock fell from 42.5 in 1983 to a low of $5.05 in 1984. As you saw this time approaching, you needed to find out what the new plan was and whether it could succeed. When there's a Wendy's next to every McDonald's, the only way Wendy's will be able to grow will be by winning over McDonald's customers. Where can Anheuser-Busch grow if it has captured 40% of the beer drinking market? Sooner or later, Anheuser-Busch is going to slow down. At that time, the stock price and the P/E multiple will shrink accordingly.
Chapter 15, The Final Checklist.
All of this research takes a couple hours at most for each stock. The more you know, the better. But you don't have to call the company. You also don't have to study the annual report with the concentration of a Dead Sea Scroll scholar. Some of the important numbers apply to specific stock categories and can be ignored when you're looking at the others. The following is a checklist of things you want to know about stocks. Check the price-earnings ratio for every stock you consider. Is it high or low for this company and for similar companies in the same industry? Look into the percentage of institutional ownership. The lower, the better. Find out whether insiders are buying and/or the company is buying back its own shares. Both are positive signs. What is the record of earnings growth to date? Are the earnings sporadic or consistent? Is the company's balance sheet weak or strong? What is the debt-to-equity ratio? How is it rated for financial strength? What is the company's cash position? For slow growers, you should check to see if the dividends have always been paid and whether they are routinely raised. The stalwarts aren't likely to go out of business, so the key issue is price. The P/E ratio will tell you whether you're paying too much. what is the stalwart's long-term growth rate? If you're planning to hold a stock forever, you want to know how the company has fared during recessions and market declines. For cyclicals, keep tabs on inventories. Remember, if you know you're cyclical, you have an advantage in trying to time the cycles. With fast growers, investigate whether the product that's supposed to enrich the company is a major part of the company's business. Has the company duplicated its successes in more than one city or town, proving that expansion works? Check to see the company still has room to grow. Find out whether the stock's P/E ratio is at or near the growth rate. How much of the stock is owned by institutions? With turnarounds, it's very important to know that the company can survive a raid by its creditors. How much cash does the company have? How much debt? What is the debt structure? How is the company supposed to be turning around? Has it rid itself of unprofitable divisions? With asset plays, you want to know the value of the assets. Are there any hidden assets? I hope you remember the following pointers from this section on picking winners. Understand the nature of the companies you own and the specific reasons for holding the stock. You'll have a better idea of what to expect from your stocks after you put them into categories. The stock of big companies makes small moves. Those of small companies make big moves. Consider the size of a company if you expect it to profit from a specific product. Look for small companies that are already profitable and have proven their concept can be successfully cloned. Avoid hot stocks and hot industries. Distrust diversifications. They usually turn out to be diversifications. Take advantage of the valuable fundamental information from your job. It may not reach the professionals for months or years. Invest in simple companies that appear dull, mundane, out of favor, and haven't caught the fancy of Wall Street. Moderately fast growers, 20 to 25% in non-growth industries are ideal investments. Look for companies with niches. When purchasing depressed stocks in troubled companies, seek out the ones with superior financial conditions. Avoid the ones with loads of bank debt. Carefully consider the price-to-earnings ratio. If the stock is grossly overpriced, even if everything else goes right, you won't make any money. Develop a storyline to follow as a way to monitor a company's progress. Look for companies that consistently buy back their own shares. Study the dividend record of a company over the years. Look for companies with little or no institutional ownership. Insider buying is a positive sign. Be patient. A watch stock never boils. Buying stocks based on stated book value alone is dangerous. Only real value counts. Invest at least as much time and effort in choosing a new stock as you would in choosing a new refrigerator.
In this section called The Long-Term View, Peter Lynch talks about how to design a portfolio to maximize gain and minimize risk. He discusses when to buy and sell stocks and what to do when the market collapses. Some of the common misconceptions about why stocks rise and fall are examined. Peter Lynch explains the pitfalls of gambling on options, futures, and the shorting of stocks. He takes a look at the stock market today and talks about how some things have changed. Chapter 16, Designing a Portfolio.
I've heard people say that they'd be satisfied with a 25 or 30% annual return from the stock market. Satisfied? At that rate, they'd soon own half the country. Even the tycoons of the 20s couldn't guarantee themselves 30% forever. That's when Wall Street was rigged in their favor. 9 to 10% return a year is the market average, and it's considered the generic long-term return for stocks. You can get 10% over time by investing in a no-load mutual fund that buys all 500 stocks in the S&P 500 index. This fund duplicates the average automatically. You can get a 9 to 10% return without doing any homework or spending any extra money. When you pick your own stocks, you ought to be getting a 12 to 15% return compounded over time. This is 12 to 15% after all costs and commissions have been subtracted and all the dividends have been added. It costs a small investor a lot of money to trade in and out. If you turn over your portfolio once a year, you might lose as much as 4% to commissions. If you're going to get 12 to 15% after expenses, you have to make 16 to 19% from picking stocks. The more you trade, the harder it will be to outperform the funds. How do you design a portfolio to get that 12 to 15% return? In my view, it's best to own as many stocks as there are situations in which you've got an edge and in which you've found an exciting prospect that passes the research tests. Maybe that will be a single stock, or maybe it's a dozen stocks. There's no point diversifying into unknown companies just for the sake of diversity. But that said, it isn't safe to own just one stock. The single stock you choose might be the victim of unforeseen circumstances in spite of your best efforts. Small portfolios should contain 3 to 10 stocks. There are a couple reasons for this. The first reason is that if you're looking for 10 baggers, the more stocks you own, the more likely one of yours will become a 10 bagger. The second reason is that the more stocks you own, the more flexibility you have to rotate funds between them. This is an important part of my strategy. Spreading your money among several stock categories is another way to minimize the risk. Beyond that, you might want to consider the following information. Slow growers are normally low risk, low gain. These stocks are usually priced accordingly. Stalwarts are low risk, moderate gain. If you own Coca-Cola, everything goes right next year, you could make 30 to 50%. If everything goes wrong, you could lose 20%. Asset plays are low risk, high gain, if you're sure of the value of the assets. Cyclicals may be low risk and high gain, or high risk and low gain, depending how well you can anticipate the cycles. If you're right, you can see 10 baggers here. If you're wrong, you can lose 80 to 90% of your investment. Additional 10 baggers can come from fast growers and from turnarounds. Both categories are high risk, high gain. If a fast grower falters or the troubled turnaround has a relapse, the downside can be losing all your money. Later on, I'll explain when to sell a stock, but here I want to discuss selling as it relates to portfolio management. I'm constantly rechecking my stocks. I add and subtract from my investments as things change. But I don't cash in because cashing in will be getting out of the market. My idea is to stay in the market and rotate stocks depending on the fundamental situations. By successfully rotating in and out of several stalwarts for modest gains, you can get the same result as you could with one big winner. I keep the fast growers as long as the earnings are growing. The expansion continues and no impediments have arisen. Same thing for cyclicals and turnarounds. You want to get out of the situations where you see the fundamentals worsen and the price increase. You want to get into situations where the fundamentals are better and the price is down. If you can't convince yourself, when I'm down 25%, I'm a buyer, and banish forever the fatal thought, when I'm down 25%, I'm a seller, then you'll never make a decent profit in stocks. I've always detested stop orders. These are automatic bailouts at predetermined prices, usually 10% below the purchase price of a stock. True, when you put in a stop order, you've limited your losses to about 10%. But in today's volatile market, a stock most always hits the stop. It's uncanny how stocks seem to shoot straight up after your stop is hit and you're out of the stock. There's no way to rely on stops as protection on the downside, just as there's no way to rely on artificial objectives as goals on the upside. If I had believed in sell when it's a double, I wouldn't have benefited from a single very, very big winner. Stick around to see what happens as long as the original story continues to make sense. You'll be amazed at the results over time.
Chapter 17, The Best Time to Buy and Sell.
I don't want to sound like a market timer and tell you there's a best time to buy stocks. The best time to buy stocks will always be the day you're convinced you found solid merchandise at a good price. However, there are two specific periods when great bargains can be found. The first is during the ritual end-of-the-year tax selling. It's no accident that the most severe drops have occurred between October and December. It's the holiday period, and brokers need spending money just like the rest of us. There's extra incentive for them to call and ask what you might want to sell to get a tax loss. Institutional investors also like to jettison the losers at the end of the year. They want to clean up their portfolios for their upcoming evaluations. All this compound selling drives stock prices down. This selling begets more selling and drives perfectly good issues to low levels. The second time to buy stocks is during the collapses, drops, burps, hiccups, and free falls that occur in the stock market every few years. If you can summon the courage to buy during these scary episodes, you'll find opportunities that you wouldn't have thought you'd ever see. Over the years, I've learned to think about when to sell the same way I think about when to buy. No single formula really applies. I pay no attention to external economic conditions, except in the instances when a specific business will obviously be affected. But more often than not, I sell when I find a company story has begun to collapse. I'll sell a slow grower after there's been a 30 to 50% appreciation or when the fundamentals have deteriorated. Additional sell signs for slow growers include the company has lost market share for two consecutive years, or the company has curtailed spending on research and development, or the company has paid so much for its acquisitions that the balance sheet has been hurt. When I sell a stalwart, I frequently replace it with another stalwart. The stock price gets above the earnings line, or the price-earnings multiple strays too far above the normal range, you might think about selling, waiting to buy it back at a lower price. Additional sell signs for stalwarts include the company's recently introduced products have had mixed results, or the company's stock has a PE of 15, while similar companies in the industry have PEs of 11 or 12, or the company's growth rate has been slowing down. I try to sell a cyclical stock towards the end of the cycle, but who knows when that is? Other than at the end of the cycle, the best time to sell is when something has actually started to go wrong. An obvious sell signal is when inventories are building up and the company can't get rid of them. Additional sell signs for cyclicals include when union contracts are about to expire and labor leaders want a restoration of the wages they gave up in the last contract, or the final demand for the product is slowing down, or the company has doubled its capital spending budget to rebuild a new plant instead of modernizing an old plant at a lower cost. Fast growers are tricky. You don't want to lose the potential 10-bagger. The main thing to watch for is the end of the second phase of rapid growth. If 40 Wall Street analysts are giving the stock their highest recommendation, 60% of the shares are held by institutions, and three national magazines have fawned over the CEO, it's definitely time to think about selling. Additional sell signs for fast growers include the company's top two executives and several key employees leave to join a rival firm, or the stock is selling at a P/E multiple of over 30, while the most optimistic earnings growth projections are 15 to 20% a year for the next 2 years, or sales have dropped 3% in the last quarter. The best time to sell a turnaround is after it's turned around. All the troubles are over, and everybody knows it. The company has become the company it was before it fell apart. Growth, cyclical, or whatever. If the turnaround has been successful, you have to reclassify the stock. Additional sell signs for turnarounds include the company's debt suddenly rises sharply, or the company's inventories are rising at twice the sales growth rate, or the P/E ratio is inflated in relation to earnings prospects. Rather than sell an asset play, I like to wait for the raider. You'll want to hold on as long as the company is not on a debt binge and reducing the value of the assets. Additional asset play sell signals include the company's management announcing it will issue 10% more shares to be sold at a discount to the real market value to finance a diversification program, But the company has sold a division which was expected to sell for $20 million, but only went for $12 million. Or institutional ownership in the company has risen from 25% to 60% in the past few years.
Chapter 18, The 12 Silliest and Most Dangerous Things People Say About Stock Prices.
Since graduate school, I've heard a continuous stream of theories about stocks. Each one is more misguided than the last. The following statements are the 12 silliest things people say about stock prices. I present them here, hoping you'll dismiss them from your mind. Silly statement number one. If it's gone down this much already, it can't go much lower. I bet the owners of Polaroid shares were repeating this very phrase after the stock had fallen a third of the way down from its high of 143.5. Polaroid had been a solid company with a blue-chip reputation. When earnings and sales collapsed, a lot of people didn't pay attention to how overpriced the stock was. Instead, they continued to reassure themselves that if it's gone down this much already, it can't go much lower. The fact is, Polaroid did go much lower. This great stock fell from $143 to $14.5 in less than a year. Only then did "it can't go much lower" turn out to be true. The truth is, there's simply no rule that tells you how low a stock can go. Silly statement number two. You can always tell when a stock has hit bottom. Bottom fishing is a popular investor pastime, but it's usually the fisherman who gets hooked. Trying to catch the bottom of a falling stock is like trying to catch a falling knife. It's normally a good idea to wait until the knife hits the ground, sticks, vibrates for a while, and settles before you try to grab it. Grabbing a rapidly falling stock results in painful surprises. You almost always grab it in the wrong place. Silly statement number three. If it's gone this high already, how can it possibly go higher? Right you are, unless, of course, you're talking about a stock like Philip Morris. Philip Morris is one of the greatest stocks of all time. If you bought Philip Morris in the 1950s for the equivalent of 75 cents a share, you might have been tempted to sell it for $2.50 a share in 1961. The theory being that this stock couldn't go much higher. 11 years later, with the stock selling for 7 times the 1961 price and 23 times the 1950s price, you might again have concluded it couldn't go any higher. But if you sold it then, you would have missed the next 7 bagger on top of the last 23 bagger. There's no arbitrary limit on how high a stock can go if the story stays good and the earnings continue to improve and the fundamentals don't change. Silly statement number four. It's only $3 a share. What can I lose? How many times have you heard people say this? Maybe you said it to yourself. You come across some stock that sells for $3 a share, and you're thinking, it's a lot safer than buying a $50 stock. I'd worked in this business for almost 20 years before it finally dawned on me that whether a stock costs $50 a share or $1 a share, if it goes to zero, you lose everything. The point is that a lousy cheap stock is just as risky as a lousy expensive stock. Silly statement number five. Eventually, they always come back. People said RCA would come back. 65 years passed, and it never did. When you consider the thousands of bankrupt companies, the solvent companies that never regained their former prosperity, and companies that get bought out at prices far below their all-time highs, you begin to see the weakness in this argument. Silly statement number six. It's always darkest before the dawn. It's very human to believe that when things have gotten a little bad, they can't get any worse. For example, people who invested on the basis of freight car deliveries were amazed when business dropped from a peak of over 95,000 units delivered in 1979 to a low less than 45,000 units in 1981. This was the lowest level in 17 years, and nobody imagined it could get worse. However, from 45,000 units, it dropped to 17,500 in 1982, and then to 5,700 in 1983. This was a whopping 90% decline in a once vibrant industry. Sometimes it's always darkest before the dawn. But then again, in the stock market, other times, it's always darkest before pitch black. Silly statement number 7. When it rebounds to $10, I'll sell. Very often, downtrodden stocks never return to the level at which you decided you'd sell. In fact, the minute you say, if it gets back to 10, I'll sell, you probably doom the stock to several years of teetering around just below 975 before it keels over to 4 on its way down to 1. This painful process may take a decade, all the while you're tolerating an investment you don't even like because some inner voice tells you to get $10 for it. Whenever I'm tempted to fall for this one, I remind myself that unless I'm confident enough in the company to buy more shares, I ought to be selling immediately. Silly statement number 8. What me worry? Conservative stocks don't fluctuate much. 2 generations of conservative investors grew up with the idea you couldn't go wrong with utility stocks. Then suddenly, there were nuclear problems and rate-based difficulties. Stocks like Consolidated Edison lost 80% of their value. Then just as suddenly, Con Ed gained back more than it had lost. There simply isn't a stock you can own that you can afford to ignore. Silly statement number 9. It's taking too long for anything to ever happen. If you give up on a stock because you're tired of waiting for something wonderful to happen, then something wonderful will begin to happen the day after you get rid of it. Most of the money I make is in the third or fourth year that I own something, although sometimes it takes longer. If all's right with the company and whatever attracted me to it hasn't changed, I'm confident that sooner or later, my patience will be rewarded. Silly statement number 10. Look at all the money I've lost. I didn't buy it. Regarding someone else's gain as your personal loss is not a productive attitude for investing in the stock market. The worst part about this kind of thinking is that it leads people to try and play catch-up. They buy stocks they shouldn't buy under the delusion they are protecting themselves from losing more than they've already lost. This usually results in real losses. Silly statement number 11. I missed that one. I'll catch the next one. The trouble is, the next one rarely works. If you missed Toys R Us, a great company that continued to go up, and bought Greenman Brothers, a mediocre company that went down, you compounded your error. You've taken a mistake that cost you nothing because you didn't lose anything by not buying Toys R Us and turned into a mistake that cost you a lot. In most cases, it's better to buy the good company at a high price than it is to jump in on the next one at a bargain price. Silly statement number 12. Stock's gone up, so I must be right. Or the stock's gone down, so I must be wrong. If I had to choose one great fallacy of investing, it's believing that when a stock's price goes up, it means you've made a good investment. All it means when a stock goes up or down after you've bought it is there was somebody who was willing to pay more or less for the same merchandise. I've bought stocks at 10 that went to 14 that now if they double, you couldn't buy a Hershey bar with them. I bought stocks at 10 that went to 6 that are now $40. It's what happens to the fundamentals that really counts over the long term.
Chapter 19, Options, Futures, and Shorts.
I've never bought a future nor an option in my entire investing career. I can't imagine buying either one now. It's hard enough to make money in regular stocks without getting distracted by these side bets. There's no point describing how futures and options really work. In the first place, it requires a long, tedious explanation, and you'd still be confused. Second, if you know more about them, you might get interested. And third, I don't understand futures and options myself. Actually, I do know a few things about options. I know that the large potential return is attractive to many small investors who are dissatisfied with getting rich slowly. Instead, they opt for getting poor quickly. That's because an option is a